For Discovery News, I'm Will Johnson. Welcome to the Friday News Feedback for the date of February the 26th, 2009. The month is always almost over, I meant to say. Almost over, but...
The month is always what, Will?
Is always rocking. The month is almost over, but the show goes on. Month after month, year
after
year. The
month is always short.
I'd like to welcome Discovery News reporters babbling away in the background. Discovery News reporter Jorge Ribas.
Hi.
And James Williams.
Hi.
Just James Williams.
Was that
well, name? I didn't say Discovery News reporter, James Williams.
Oh, am I not a Discovery News reporter this week?
You are.
All
right. Let me turn your microphone up there, James.
That's terrific. Thanks.
All right. Welcome to the show. Each week, James and Jorge each bring us their three favorite stories. Did I just mess it up?
No. I was going to say.
Yeah, each bring us their three favorite stories of the week.
And fact.
Then you, and then you
fact.
Get to choose your favorite. That's my new way of saying it.
Yeah.
To avoid that verb agreement problem I have.
Yeah.
So choose your favorite stories, and then these guys get to celebrate and have a great time.
It's phenomenal.
So do you guys have some good stories?
How do we celebrate again?
I don't know.
By not doing a prize for every year that we've done this?
I do have three great stories this week.
Yeah. Do you?
Yeah, I do.
James, in particular, is fired up. We will get to the score and everything else, but we've got someone waiting on the line, so why don't we...
What?
Or should we do the score?
No, let's wait.
We have an
anticipation.
Interview.
All right, we'll get to the score after something very special is happening. James, did you line up an interview this week?
Yes,
nice.
I did.
All right.
Well done.
Then I will let you introduce the interview.
We're going to speak with Jimmy Rogers. One of our listeners sent us a story from a blog called Geeks Are Sexy, and I looked at this blog, and it is a good blog, and so we are interviewing one of them, one of the bloggers, because... I talked to him a little bit. He wanted to get in on the three stories action, so he's going to give us three stories from their blog, Geeks Are Sexy, that he thinks are good.
All right, good work, James.
You said blog a dozen times.
Yeah.
And that's the
blog, 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 blog. What, is that what I'm saying to you guys? Blog, blog, blog. You want me to keep going with that?
Let me see if I can rouse
Blogger.
Him up, okay? All right, so I think he's on the line now. Jimmy, are you there?
I am.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Glad to be on the show.
So Geeks Are Sexy.
Apparently.
So tell us a little more background about what you do.
Well, Geeks Are Sexy in general is kind of a mishmash of a lot of things. We not only talk about, you know, the big, funny, cool videos that you might see on the web, but also we try to get into some of the geek and web culture that's kind of out there that maybe not everybody knows about. And also recently we've started doing a lot more science content.
And also... bacon.
Yes. I have a treat for you guys kind of at the end. I have a story about bacon and somewhere that you could put it that you might not expect.
Oh, okay. We love bacon.
That's a good treat. A better treat was actually if you had bacon here that you had delivered.
But at least he's going to get us.
No, I know.
If bacon started coming
through the phone. I apologize. I should have thought of that ahead of time.
No, it's okay.
Has anyone ever created bacon-flavored cologne?
No, I think they have soap. I think they have soap.
Really?
They probably do.
At my brother's restaurant, they make bacon-flavored ice cream. So
I've heard of that.
That is true.
I think ice cream is...
That sounds pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. You know what? I don't necessarily like those bacon bits.
Well, because usually... Isn't it sometimes they're not even... It's not even bacon. It's like some kind of processed...
It's kind of fake.
Yeah.
Think of all the number of things that you could disguise as bacon bits. I don't even want to think... You know what? I'm going to stop thinking about it because I don't want to think
You could just
that.
Eat gravel. Gravel. Just right. Take gravel and flavor it.
All right, I feel like we're wasting Jimmy's time.
Right.
Although it's probably my fault. All right, Jimmy.
Oh, no, this is valuable conversation.
Bacon chat. Let's rename our show.
Bacon chat. Just a couple guys sitting around chatting about bacon.
It would be, in a week, it would be the most popular podcast on iTunes.
You know what? I'm sure that bacon chat exists.
Yeah.
I think you do need to put bacon on the shirt somewhere, though.
Yes.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
All right, I don't want to scare the cows off, though.
Oh, that's true.
All right.
Cows aren't made of bacon.
Cows aren't made of bacon.
I know, but still, just
pigs
the idea
of bacon.
Other, look, doy, but I'm just saying the sight of another animal
chickens,
slaughtered in front of them.
Chickens aren't made
Dude,
of bacon.
We'll just use the time-honored third grade counterpoint, doy.
All right, Jimmy.
I'm sorry. This is the last time I'm going to interrupt.
Well, to pick back up on what I was saying, basically that's what the site does. And so personally, I'm a freelancer for them. And I'm a graduate student in a microbiology program at University of Maryland, just down the road from you guys. I am kind of the science go-to guy whenever some weird science story, like the H1N1 flu came up, or before that was bird flu. So I did a lot of influenza stories around those times.
Huh, okay. So, well, and at the end, of course, we'll tell people how to find Geeks Are Sexy. It's pretty easy, I would imagine.
Yeah, .net.
All right.
There you go.
Just add a .net on the end?
Done.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I had a suggestion. Since you guys usually do three stories a week,
yes.
I have three stories that we have done and are working on, and I thought I might share them with you to kind of fit into your format.
That sounds terrific.
Yeah.
Let's hear what they are.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And to clarify for our listeners, you do not vote on Jimmy's stories. This is just an extra special bonus feature.
No, why not?
Well, we talked about it, but I think it would mess up. You know,
it would mess up the scientific.
The end of the
bell
year will be
curve.
Like 26
yeah.
James, 24 Jorge, yeah. and one for Jimmy.
It would compromise.
Everyone will forget who I am. So
it would compromise the integrity of this podcast.
Yeah, yeah right.
Voting
yeah,
and
system.
Newer listeners towards the end of the year would be like, why does Jimmy have a point? Who right. is he? You know.
I don't think anyway it would be that big a deal. But I hear you. I hear you. Yeah. I'm gonna go with what you guys say.
All right. Well,
go ahead, Jimmy.
Well, my first story was actually, I'm pretty sure it's the first story we ever wrote in a more serious science vein, and it. Still one of the most popular stories we've had, so I thought I'd share it. It's basically a description of what is cancer and why the term cure for cancer is a kind of a weak statement.
Hmm.
So you hear the cure for cancer as this golden scientific thing that everybody wants to discover, and it kind of went into how cancer is a natural state of the body, and so instead of focusing on how to cure it and to say, oh, we need to make this drug and it will fix the whole problem, it's more of a understanding how the body works and as part of the system.
Hmm. So it's a natural part of the body in the sense that like a cold or the flu is?
Even more so, because every cell grows and grows and grows until it reaches a natural stopping point caused by a number of different factors. But if any mutations occur or if the immune system fails to catch problems, that cell will simply continue to do what it always does, which is grow, and that is what cancer is. It's basically a continuous growth of a cell that never got stopped. And so it's even easier for it to happen than, say, a common cold or something. Eventually, all animals develop cancer because eventually those checks break down over time.
Huh. That's why
it's a disease of the aged.
Animals including humans?
Including humans.
That's sad. Huh. I think that's sad.
So
yeah, I mean,
I guess I'm...
but I think it's important that people don't think it's something that you get like a cold. Instead, it's something that your body deals with every day. I mean, cancer cells actually occur more commonly than you might expect, but the immune system picks them off, or the cells realize that they're cancerous and go through their own basically self-suicide called apoptosis.
So what we should be talking about then isn't necessarily a cure for cancer, but rather a delay in cancer.
A delay, or maybe understanding all the different bajillion little ways that cancer can pop up and how they might be treated individually. I know a number of cancers have been cured with drugs that target them, but having a universal cure for all cancer is like saying we'll stop having hair. We just want to cure hair. It's just part of what we are.
Hmm. Jimmy, there are some cancers that are transferred by a virus, right? I know that there's an animal, the Tasmanian devil there's a cancer that's spreading among them by a virus, I think.
Yeah, actually viruses and bacteria can both cause cancer, but what they do is they accelerate the process that normally causes cancer.
Ah.
So if a virus jumps into your DNA, it invariably will cause a mutation. And that mutation can sometimes be a mutation in a gene, for instance, for stopping cell growth at a certain point.
Hmm.
And so if the cell is supposed to stop and do a check at a certain point to make sure it's okay, and if it never stops there, it will just continue to grow forever. So the virus can definitely jump in and do that.
That's quite fascinating and interesting.
Good story.
Let's hear number two.
Okay, number two. This one's a little bit less depressing. It's got by the way, if you look it up on our site, I can send you guys links to all these stories. This has a great picture of a sea slug. It's called Alicia chlorotica, and it is a sea slug that kind of has this really interesting interaction with the algae that it lives with. So these things are born basically white, and as they mature, they become green because they steal the chloroplasts, the little bodies that hold the chlorophyll in algae, from those organisms and take it up into their own body so that they can produce energy from sunlight.
So they
actually become plants.
So they co-opt the ability of the plants as their own.
That is exactly right. The weird thing that this is not super unique in, I guess, this organism, but we've known about it for a while. The thing we didn't know is that eventually that chlorophyll in those little chloroplasts runs out. It gets depleted. And they always thought they just stole more chloroplasts to replenish them. But it seems that the sea slug itself has co-opted the genes from the plant and has started producing chlorophyll on its own, which pretty much is unique in the animal kingdom.
So
we've never really seen plants and animals touch tips of the tree of life like that before.
So that's basically the slug equivalent of a superhero, in a sense,
yeah,
right?
Pretty much, or more like Swamp Thing.
Oh, right.
Swamp Thing.
So this is
part plant, part animal.
And so what you're saying is this is basically the only case that we know of in nature where one creature has adopted the powers of another creature and it made it into its own superpower.
Well, actually, this happens all the time in bacteria. Bacteria are so similar, and they have such similar, simple systems that frequently they interchange their genes. But on higher-order organisms like plants or like the sea slug, which is an animal, even though we may think of it as a low-level organism, in the tree of life it's pretty high up, they're really, really, really far apart genetically. And so the fact that they can kind of reach back and still talk to each other genetically is really surprising.
That's cool. Well, very cool. All right, let's hear number three, Jimmy.
Okay, number three is now this is a little bit more hard science, but I worked very hard to try and trim it down to what really matters.
We can take it.
Okay.
I told Jimmy if it gets too dense, he can talk about the brownies.
Yeah. See, that's my backup plan.
We are. Yeah. We're also all three of us are molecular biologists, so we should be all right.
Oh, okay.
What brownies?
Oops. I gave away what the story was.
Oh, yeah,
what are you doing? Oh, no. Ignore me. Go.
What?
There's more to it, but I'll tell you the other one, the
I've
harder one.
All right.
So your genes in your body are written in your DNA in a genetic code. Everybody knows that there's a genetic code. Mm-hmm. And you might have learned that code is made of three letters at a time. So these little blocks of three letters are recognized by a special enzyme called a ribosome. And it can then take that information and turn it into structure. So it's kind of the interface between the blueprint for who you are and the structure and the proteins that make you up.
Huh.
And so this is really a very important thing because that code is the same from all the way to the lowest organisms all the way to the highest organisms. Actually, it kind of goes with the last story because without that code being the same, there would be impossible for a plant and an animal to ever talk to each other genetically. So what happened is, so researchers in Cambridge have created a special ribosome. Basically, they've modified the naturally occurring ribosome, which is that protein, the enzyme that can recognize genetic code, and they've made it recognize a fourth base at a time. So now they can write code in four base blocks, and instead of recognizing the old code, which only really went to 20 building blocks, 20 amino acids, now they can plug in anything they want into the code that has been man-made, not found in nature. This is basically a huge, huge step forward for people wanting to do work with synthetic biology.
So this means that they can now, they've figured out how to create things that don't exist in nature at all.
Well, they've been able to make them like in a very complex system in a laboratory, but they've never been able to actually just build it into DNA so that they can just take DNA, drop it into a tube with this ribosome, and it will make gallons of this stuff automatically. That's the beauty of modern genetics, is that it's so automatic.
So give us an example. What's something that they've created or are creating?
Well, the guys in Cambridge, they took a non-naturally occurring amino acid as their example. And it's a cyclic amino acid, which I believe, I'm not a biochemist at all, but I believe the difference is that it's cyclic, which is a structural thing. And so they've been able to put that into a protein created by their ribosome. And see, the future is that we will have a much greater ability to control structure of proteins, which is very important in drug synthesis. But even more, we might even be able to pull in things other than proteins, carbohydrates, lipids, the other major building blocks in cells. Theoretically, you could drop in a piece of code, and you could create all of the components of an entire cell in one altogether system, which is just mind-boggling to those of us who kind of built up the old system in our minds.
But what does that mean, though? What are we going to, in 10 years when they develop this stuff further, what does that mean? Are we going to have something, like, what are we going to do with this?
Well, there are a lot of people right now working on synthetic organisms, for instance. Mm-hmm. So people who want to build organisms that are not found in nature. And we've already created one in the laboratory, Mycobacterium Laboratorium, actually, is the name. Mm-hmm. And it's got a custom genome. So that's kind of the first step. So theoretically, you can make an organism that could make very complex products that could not be found, could not be done with, like, E. coli, which is our common method of making proteins. Or you could go in and, I mean, it's almost impossible for me to say because it's such a new area and such a promising area. It's almost hard for me to imagine all of the diversity that we can work with. We haven't figured out what we could do with it.
What about a sharkopotamus?
You know, wow, that might just be the next big thing. You may be right onto it.
Just curious.
I don't know where it would live.
Would that be freshwater or salt? Maybe brackish.
That's the question.
That would be brackish.
My only concern is that those who work in the name of evil do not get their hands on this. That's fascinating stuff,
kidding.
Though.
That's always the fear. But I think right now this stuff is in such unstable condition that only the best and brightest are going to be able to really do too much with mm-hmm. this. But
that's what you think.
I could probably do something with it.
That's what you'd like to hope. All right, man. Well, those are awesome stories.
Yeah.
And my only question is, why can't James and Jorge bring us stories?
Oh, come on now.
I won't hold off my brownie story.
Oh, yes, let's hear it. Yeah. I thought it was a bacon story.
Got you guys listening to all this science stuff in the first place. And,
all right, yeah, let's hear it.
So one of our writers, who is actually a guest blogger for, I think it was last week, her story, it's still up on the front page, gave us a recipe for fudge brownies that include a pound of bacon.
Hmm. That's delicious.
And so I'll just read what it is. Basically, it's a standard box brownie mix, 2 eggs, half a cup of vegetable oil,
one
water,
hard tap,
and then half a pound of bacon diced up into half-inch squares.
I would feel like that would be great. You know, you get a little sweet and salty. That's always a good combination.
Yeah.
Have you tried it?
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't, actually. I'm sure they're amazing. Apparently, she took them to a con and gave them out to people and was congratulated both in person and on Twitter.
Wait, when you say a con, are you talking like a conference?
Contest?
I guess it's called Alcon, but I've never heard of it. But I think
Comic-Con.
Or perhaps it was Baycon.
That's good, James.
Thank you.
We should start
a Baycon. You found that. Yeah. You really should.
There's got to be. There's probably a Baycon.
Well, Jimmy, here's the deal.
That's
If you haven't had it, I guarantee you this week we have a legion of loyal listeners who do pretty much anything we tell them, and they will no doubt make this bacon brownie. Someone will make it and send us an
James
email.
James and Jorge do not.
Yeah, they really should. They should do that. If you guys get sent any brownies, you should let me know so I can try them out myself.
Jimmy, I will let you try them because I make it a practice not to eat anything that is sent to me through the mail.
Really?
By unknown people.
Well, if I may, can I put in my plug now? If I earned a plug for
Yeah. Go crazy.
So geeksaresexy.net, which is the full domain. That you can see all of our stories there. You can. I'll send the links so you can get links to all the stories I mentioned. Also, you can follow me on Twitter with @LoyalEagle, one word, Loyal Eagle. And that's pretty much the best way to, you know, see all the stuff that I do myself.
All right.
Groovy.
Well, Jimmy, this has been a special treat, and geeksforsexy.net is definitely cool, and we urge our listeners to check it out.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Love the show.
Thanks, man.
Jimmy.
All right, there he is, Jimmy Rogers.
Why did you say that your legions of loyal fans could follow? That made me think that you were the evil
listeners
doctor.
For granted.
What do you mean, I said my instead of our?
I don't know, but it sounded like you were the evil mastermind.
Listeners, we don't take anyone for granted, except for Will.
How did I take our listeners for granted? I simply
Horrible.
Said that they follow our instructions.
No, you sounded like,
did you guys,
like a Dr. Evil.
Did you guys notice that when we first had him on, he had to get the three of us back on track because we were talking about
we went off on bacon.
I don't know. I feel like we've been talking for 30 minutes.
I know.
We need to get
Should
show.
We just wrap up?
I feel like we should.
That's not a bad
should
idea.
Should we just do
you
a
could
you
save
just
these for next week?
We could.
There'd be no voting.
Nah, let's do the show.
Okay.
All
right. So
should we just read blurbs?
Last week the score was 4-3 with Jorge in the lead.
Yeah.
This week, Jorge wins again with a new material that mimics Bone Story. He is now 5-3 ahead of James.
That
James
one?
Lagging behind. That one. All right, so let's get to the stories.
All right.
James, go.
All right. So how much do you all wish that you could have one password for your internet?
Oh, man.
Everything.
And that use it everywhere, right?
I'd be a much happier person in general.
Forget them all the time.
Yeah, and how much did you guys hate the 80s?
I like the 80s.
Well, it's all coming full circle. Yeah. There's a system that dates, an anonymous credential system that dates back to the 80s that has recently received renewed interest from the research community. That's a lot of R's. This is from the Queensland University of Technology. They're saying that using this credential system, we could enhance the security and privacy of a single sign-on system. It works by revealing as little information about you as necessary for logging into an account, which allows you to remain anonymous. They say that way a company wouldn't be able to track your shopping habits or target spam or marketing at you, but it could also confirm that you are over 18 and without revealing your birthday. So
everything from the 80s is coming back.
And the passcode should be first name, last name.
Right, or password one.
Or test. Yeah. So I actually heard
any variation of your pet's name.
I've heard that really, I mean, the safest approach to passwords is to change them out as frequently as possible.
Ugh.
This is for real, or at least what I heard from someone who sounded smart and knew about it. And it should be as complicated as possible. So really, a password with 100 characters in it, random characters, is better than one that's, I mean, this makes sense, I guess, is better than one with 50.
Yeah,
you forget it.
Yeah,
you could just copy and paste it, but then maybe that's
you're going to type 100 characters into a password. Are you
that's
kidding
what I
me?
Heard this person telling me.
Well, that's
or
ridiculous.
This person on the radio talking to me only. It sounds like, yeah, maybe I'm wrong.
All my
I'm
passwords.
Sure, we've got some people out there who
all
are
my passwords
persons.
Are 12345.
My password is James Williams 89.
Why 89?
Yeah, why?
I don't know. I was just thinking of a random.
That was the most rocking year in Will Jackson's life.
That's the random part.
89.
All right. So anyway, it's possible that there will be we will all be reduced to just one single password when we use the interwebs in the future.
Interesting that something that was created so long ago and in such archaic times.
Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah. All right. 80s.
Yeah. All right, Jorge, your first story.
All right, would you guys like to have a detector, basically a baby translator?
No.
Would you guys think that useful?
I don't know. Want to know what they're saying.
All right. Well, researchers from a scientist, actually Japanese scientists, report that that details of a statistical computer program could analyze babies crying. And it means that baby monitors of the future could translate infant cries so that parents would know for certain whether their child is sleepy, hungry, needing a change, or in pain. And what they did is basically they used something called the product design that they use is something known as Kensei Engineering, which was invented in the 1970s, which aims to measure feelings and emotions. And the team employed a sound pattern recognition approach that uses a statistical analysis of the frequency of cries and the power function of the audio spectrum to classify different types of crying. They used these on children who had – it's kind of sort of sad, but in their test of recordings of crying babies – that had a painful genetic disorder were used to make differentiating between a baby's pain cries and other types of crying. And what they found is they achieved 100% success rate in validation of like pain cries and normal ones. I don't really know if that, I mean, I guess you could tell the difference, that they could tell the difference between a child who's in pain and a child who needs like a
but
diaper
then the
change.
Other stuff.
But then what about between a diaper change and a
and
food?
Hungry.
Right, or just maybe stuff. They're just gassy.
Yeah, it doesn't really answer that in this brief blurb, does it?
They cry. I mean, they obviously cry for everything because that's all they can really do.
Right,
so.
That's how they communicate.
This is the thing, too, and not to belittle the story because Lord knows it'll probably win this week, but the But I would also like the intuition of the parent is probably pretty right on most of the time anyway.
They mentioned that. They say that while unfortunately the parenting handbook does not offer guidance on how to determine the crying, parents usually learn with experience what their child's
trust,
crying.
As soon as your kid starts crying, you start trying every single thing you can until they stop.
You know how they
and then you figure it out.
You know how you know if they need a change? It smells.
Wow.
Sometimes.
Thanks, Will.
All right,
parenting tips from Will Johnson.
We should get an emotion detector for Will Johnson would be great. To just to know, like, I don't know if you're bored right now, you're tired, you're hungry, you're cranky.
I'm none of the above, man.
You're bored. I mean, yeah, when you're checking email, I know, okay, there's the emotion detector for right. Will being bored.
All right, James, your second story of the week, please.
Second story, it's being published in Nature. Some scientists think they have found one of the driving forces or the driving force behind evolution. And So and now
sounds like an important story, James.
It does, doesn't it? They say it, up till now, we've all sort of heard that the thing about evolution has to do with the environment, right? Like animals are adapting to their environments, and that's what's driving it, right? Have you heard this?
I feel like I've heard different things about evolution. Right.
Well, they say historically it was assumed most evolution was driven by the need to adapt to the environment or habitat. But what these folks are saying is there's this Red Queen hypothesis, which challenges this by pointing out that actually most natural selection will arise from co-evolutionary interactions with other species and not from interactions with the environment. So in other words, as one species adapts to gain an advantage over another species, that causes that other species to adapt to try and regain that advantage and gain an advantage.
Isn't this kind of Darwin?
Yeah, that's evolution. But in the past, what's different about this is that what they're saying is that it's not the environment that's driving those evolutionary changes, but rather the interaction with other creatures that is driving that change.
But isn't that what Darwin argued, that it's the survival of the fittest?
Right, but it's not saying Darwin was wrong. It's agreeing with Darwin.
But so what's new about it?
Because
that it's not the environment.
I just explained, right. That they're saying that it's not. It's historically it's been thought that the environment was the thing that was driving evolution, but they're saying it's not.
But that's what I'm saying. Isn't he sort of the guy who really developed a lot of these ideas? And so historically, the number one. I mean, are you separating survival of the species from the environment? What does the environment mean?
Will's emotion detector is on skeptical.
Just trying to figure it out.
I guess I don't understand what's confusing you. There's the environment that the physical place that we live in.
Yes.
And then there are animals that live within that physical place.
Okay, so I'm just surprised to hear that this sort of idea of species, sort of trying to deal with each other in one way or the other and getting better, it isn't the historical notion of why evolution.
Apparently, it was not. Apparently, they're saying that historically it's been assumed that it was the need to adapt to your habitat or your environment, and they're saying no.
Right. Apologies to all those out there who know a lot more about this than I do.
Yeah.
I shouldn't be arguing with this. Obviously, I'm wrong, right?
That since we've been employed here at Discovery, we've evolved differently.
I feel like I have a little bit, Jorge.
With the environment and with the people.
I've evolved to be able to deal with the two of you.
All right. Again, apologies. I ask questions sometimes just to create a little excitement.
That was exciting.
All right, Hori, your second story
for everybody
of the week, please.
Do you guys watch old movies?
Yes.
Or new documentaries?
And always.
New documentaries?
What is old? Never.
Like prior to, like the 1940s, 1950s.
Like talkies?
Yeah. But have you noticed how the old movies, and not just like because they're black and white, but they feel different, right? They feel different than modern movies, like when you're watching them.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's a reason behind that.
Everybody talked in sort of funny accents that didn't really sound like we talked today. First of all, I won't argue
there
that.
There is a little bit of that. But the science, so here's kind of, this is pretty interesting. So a cognitive psychologist and film buff, James Cutting of Cornell University, along with students, decided to use sophisticated tools of modern perception research to deconstruct 70 years of film shot by shot. They measured the duration of each shot in every scene of 150 of the most popular movies released from 1935 to 2005.
They're longer.
Basically, these films were like, action, adventure, animation, comedy, and drama. And they used a complex mathematical formula for each shot length describe as waves for each film. And what they looked at specifically was a pattern called 1F fluctuation. And it's a concept from chaos theory that means a pattern of attention that occurs naturally in the human mind. And what they found is that more modern films, so films made after 1980, were much more likely than earlier film to approach this kind of 1F, like human, natural human mind concept, like this idea of our natural fluctuation. And all earlier films didn't employ that technique as much. And what they think is that these shots films have evolved. And, earlier films that didn't employ like this natural kind of, this fluctuation weren't as popular as movies that did employ that. So directors and cinematographers and editors started using those techniques, and naturally, like, movies became more in tune with our minds.
So I would assume it would mean more like real life. It's more camera angles, more shots, maybe more pacing, etc.
I think so. And they say that modern movies tend to be more engrossing, and we get lost in them more readily than you do in earlier movies and movies that from like the 40s or
makes
the 50s.
Sense. Yeah.
What do you guys think about that?
What's James thinking about?
Evolution.
The evolution of film.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting because I do think that, like, I'll watch, you know, I like old movies, but I do kind of, you know, I don't really, sometimes they just feel that, like, I'm watching a play on TV. You know, that you definitely don't have, they're not quite as engrossing. And somebody, you know, somebody may be like a film buff that would completely disagree with me on that.
Yeah, there are a lot.
You know, I think. But I don't know.
Yeah. Do you like old movies, James?
Nah.
I got to say, I get a little bored sometimes.
Yeah. I like to think I like old movies.
Yeah, me too.
But like
it's because it's cool to like old movies, right?
Like Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
It's like, if you don't like Citizen Kane, then you don't know movies. But you know what?
You basically lie to yourself to say, like, I love that movie.
I have that movie in my DVD collection. I've had it in my DVD collection for years.
Have you watched it?
No.
Just to make yourself
Because what? Because, yeah.
You gotta have the time and the energy and the space to like sit down and watch it. You know, too many distractions in modern life.
Right.
I think I can go back to like the early 70s, and maybe that's kind of the cutoff point.
What about you know who's good as Hitchcock?
True.
Yeah.
I can watch.
You know what? Yeah, you're right. I do
like the Hitchcock.
He was good at the suspense.
He was good at his suspense.
All right. Apologies to all movie buffs.
Right.
I can go back to like 1995.
Yeah, that's true, actually. It's hard to watch. Actually, I think it's hard to watch movies from 10 years ago. It's probably easier to watch one from 30 years ago where, right. You know, it is what it is. But when you watch one from 10 years ago, all you can think of is how bad the...
Movies begin and end with me with Beethoven.
The dog movie? Nice.
All right, let's move on.
All right.
James, your third story.
Yeah, you know, before we go to my third story, I want to make a clarification on my second
Beethoven
story.
Beethoven is a documentary.
James is
upset at you.
No, I'm not upset. I would just want to clarify this. That theory... has been around since the 70s. So what this research did, they used viruses and they confirmed
the environment theory has been around.
That it was that the evolution was driven by interaction with other species or with other creatures.
Right.
That theory is more so than the environment. That's been around since the 70s, but they were able to prove it. They used viruses and this is the first time that they've seen it in action.
So it's actually different from what Darren was saying. If it was from the 70s, somehow that argument is different. We're not quite tapping into the big story here.
I don't know. I'm not quite sure where you come. I just wanted to clarify that it's not. This isn't a brand new theory that's coming. That's out. They're saying that this is the first time that they've put this theory into practice.
Okay.
And seen results.
Thank you, James.
Okay.
Thank you for confusing all of us. I'm throwing me into a quandary.
I think I'm just confusing you. Okay. My third story, also dealing with evolution. I don't even know if I want to do this. This is in current biology. Yeah. They're saying that promiscuous females may be the key to a species' survival. This is according to research by the universities of Exeter and Liverpool.
No comment.
It's called polyandry amongst scientists. And it's the phenomenon of females having multiple mates. And it's shared across most animal species from insects to mammals. What this study suggests is that polyandry reduces the risk of populations becoming extinct because of all female broods being born. And this sometimes happens as a result of a sex ratio distortion chromosome, which results in all of the Y chromosome male sperms being killed before fertilization. So the all-female offspring will carry this SR chromosome, which will be passed on to their sons, in turn resulting in more all-female broods. And eventually there will be no more males and the population will die out. And so to test this, they used fruit flies. They gave some populations the opportunity to mate naturally, meaning that the females had multiple partners, and in others they were restricted to just having one mate each. They bred for several generations, and so they could see how they react. Over 15 generations, 5 of the 12 populations that had been monogamous became extinct as a result of the males dying out.
I love that the 15 generations for fruit flies is like, what, 3 days?
Yeah, it's like probably 5-10 minutes.
It's awesome. It would take a while for humans.
Interesting, James.
Yep.
I don't even know how to talk about it without being inappropriate.
Without offending everybody.
Yeah. It wasn't...
Just an interesting story.
All right. All right.
Jorge, your third and final story, please.
That was the shortest discussion for a story ever.
I think the story said it all. All right, Jorge, your third and final story.
All right, so my last story is University of Florida engineers have achieved something pretty cool. They've basically created a flat surface that refuses to get wet. And what they said is water droplets skitter across it like ball bearings would on ice, which I think is a funny analogy just because who throws ball bearings on ice? But I guess
guilty.
Done it.
Every winter, it's a winter pastime at the Williams household.
Yeah, it's just a little,
let's go
it's
down
a good,
to the lake and throw some ball bearings.
It's a good stress reliever.
So this is... Oh, go ahead.
All right. Well, in the journal Langmuir, that's a very strange journal name. Langmuir? Sounds like an airport.
Langmuir.
Basically, they mimic the hairs that you would find on a spider, on the bodies of spiders, these minute hairs, to achieve something they call nearly perfect hydrophobic interface. So they're using physics instead of chemistry to make this surface hydrophobic, so water just repellent. There's already chemicals and stuff that are out there that you can put on your shoes or on your car windshield that make water beat off it, basically. But this time they're using physics. So basically, theoretically, they say it's a technique that you could use on other things. So you could make water sop, and you could switch it on and off. So you could make like a sponge that like fills up with water, and you switch these hairs, and all of a sudden the water just like repels off it.
Can you buy stuff to put on your windshield to make water go off of it?
Oh yeah.
Should I do that? Have you guys done it?
When you buy new cards, usually on there.
That's
what I'm saying. It's not like you go to the store and buy like a bottle.
You can go to the store and buy something to apply to your windshield that will do that.
Have you done this? I feel like I want to because it's.
I think there's a.
We have that on one of our cars. It hasn't worn off yet.
You can tell it makes a difference.
What if you just sprayed it all over your house? Would water just like?
I like to spray that all over my face so I don't have rain in my face.
So this is sort of.
You imagine if you just saw James walking down the street and it was raining, you're like, "Hey," and he was like,
"Water's just bouncing off."
And he's like, "Everyone else is like raincoat. With like an umbrella." And he's just walking like in a t-shirt, and he's like, "How's it going?" And water's just like flipping off, like
and I'm completely dry.
James Williams does not wear raincoats.
That would be amazing. Or
need umbrellas.
To see.
No good, sir. He
he's
doesn't.
Like completely dry.
Yeah.
You should dry.
So this is sort of the future of rain gear.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds kind of cool. It sounds like, you know, if you don't need chemicals, you just like create. You're mimicking nature once again.
Your spider.
Knows the answer. You're a spider. You have a spider jacket. You know.
Right. Nice.
Okay. To recap, James, go ahead.
Okay, so they're working on a safe way to use one internet password everywhere. Scientists reveal the driving force behind evolution, and another group of scientists answers the question: does promiscuity prevent extinction?
Hooray!
Okay, my first story was an emotion detector for a baby. My second story was science of Hollywood blockbusters, and my last story was water may not run uphill, but it practically flies off new surface.
Well done, gentlemen. And Jorge, do you have some social liaison information for us this week?
Yeah, I do. We got some good stuff.
The mailbag.
This is on the Facebook page, actually.
Okay.
Todd writes in that he found our listener comment number. It's 1-888-890-6339.
Yeah, and I actually got a call from another guy who was bummed out because we talked about there being a message, and I hadn't checked the message. So, sir, I did get your voicemail, and thank you.
Wait a minute. Did you just say 4-8?
1-888? No, I might have. 1-888-890.
Oh, yeah. Okay. No, that's
6339.
Did you test that before you read it on the air live?
No.
Yeah, because do we know for sure that that's not?
We'll test it out.
Yeah.
We'll test. Bill.
I'm sure it's fine.
I'm sure it'll work out. Bill writes in, he had a cool image.
Can't just read anything, you know, that people send us, Jorge.
Well, yeah, I tend to just read whatever comes across my desk. He had a cool graphic for pitcher potion. And I think that was James' story about the pitcher plant. And it's like
I made that up, the pitcher potion.
Yeah, but he had a cool graphic.
I saw
he actually
that,
made
yeah,
a label.
On the feed blog. Yeah, that was cool.
You made it up, but he actually went forward with it.
Well, took it one step. He implemented.
Yeah.
Jeff wrote in that he had...
I'm strategy, he's implementation.
Good team, you two.
And my favorite post of the week was Jeff, who posted a link to a pop versus soda map.
Yes.
And it was a map
pop,
of the U.S.
Wait, so pop versus soda.
Pop versus soda.
Some people say pop and some people say soda.
It was a map of the U.S. And basically, here's what it came up with, is that the Northwest and Midwest go by pop. The Northeast and California and Southwest mostly go by soda. The South is like Coke territory, which is interesting because Coke is based in Atlanta. So that sort of makes sense. You know?
Yeah.
And Maryland's sort of in the middle. You know,
true.
Just like everything else, Maryland and D.C. is kind of a mix
of
everything.
A hodgepodge.
Yeah. Here's my biggest question. There was a couple green areas. Green indicated other. And I think it was split up by like counties. So there was like a huge county in New Mexico that was full green. So it was other. So that means there's a county of New Mexico that calls soda by something completely different.
Or they just don't drink it or refer to it.
Yeah, to refer.
If you start to say
it
something,
it is the thing that has no name.
I want to find out. I'm asking listeners, if you don't call it soda or pop or Coke, what do you call it?
Good question, Jorge.
You know.
Good science.
Maybe you call it like carbonated water beverage.
Yeah.
Maybe you say I don't know.
Maybe
any number of things.
Yeah. Just tell me what you come up with.
All right. That's great stuff, Jorge. Anything else?
Listener James, actually it's James right here, posted a link on YouTube that was funny. The annoying orange.
Okay, thanks. All right, if you'd like to email us, you can email us at pod_cast@discovery.com. James, where can people go find us on the feed blog?
news.discovery.com/feedblog. I feel like the wheels are barely staying on the bus this week.
And there's also the Facebook page, Jorge. Just go to facebook.com and search for...
Discovery Friday News Feedback Fans Unite. Go to Twitter, Feedback Nation.
Can't you just type... Okay, you can type in Friday News Feedback.
Yeah, you'll find it.
And pretty soon, a listener noted that we have over 1,000 members so that we can make our own Facebook page, like facebook.com/feedback, hopefully. Unless it already exists. I didn't even check. So something like that.
No, I don't think it exists.
Is there another feedback show out there that we don't know of?
Uh-oh.
The Tuesday afternoon feedback.
Where they each bring their two favorite stories of the week. All right, guys. Thanks a lot for all of your help this week on the show.
Oh, thanks. And Will, glad to be here.
It's been a fun 4 hours, guys.
For Discovery News, I'm Will Johnson.